Today is February the 23rd, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is www.pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. We are nearing now, almost at the beginning of a third year, of a home lockdown, which was begun back on March the 19th, 2020. Here's hoping we are in the final stage of a lockdown. I'm eagerly looking forward to returning into the studio for live calls from you, the listening audience. In the meantime, however, you can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Verizon Fios begins offering multi-gig home internet speeds in New York City. The provider's fastest plan is available in select areas of the city and will be rolled out to additional markets later this year. Verizon's fastest plan offers upload and download speeds as high as 2.3 gigabits per second. Select areas of the New York City markets will be able to sign up for the Fios 2 gigabit connection plan, which offers upload and download speeds as high as 2.3 gigabits per second. Verizon Fios, the company's 100% fiber optic home internet service, is available in 8 northeastern states and the District of Columbia. In most markets, it offers three plans: Fios 300, which is 300 megabits per second, download and upload speeds; Fios 500, which is 500 megabits per second, download and upload; and Fios Gigabit, 940 megabits download and 880 megabits upload. Now, some customers in the Big Apple will be able to try out the fastest plan the provider has yet to offer. Fios 2 gigabit connection will feature download and upload speeds between 1.5 and 2.3 gigabits per second, according to a press release. With autopay enabled, the plan will cost $120 a month, which includes a router rental, a Wi-Fi extender, if requested at no extra charge, and 2 terabytes of cloud storage. Additional perks includes enticements for new customers are a $200 Verizon gift card, a free year of AMC Plus and Disney Plus, and $300 off a Stream TV soundbar. Customers can also save $20 a month with select unlimited wireless plans. Like all Fios plans, the Fios to a gigabit connection tier has no data cap and requires no annual contract. Customers who order online will also have the $99 setup fee waived. While the Fios 2 gigabit connection plan is available immediately in portions of New York, it won't be unveiled in additional markets until sometime later this year. There's arguably no better internet connection type than fiber optic. It's fast, reliable, and often reasonably priced. Unfortunately, it's also one of the least available internet types. Less than half of U.S. households can get it, and service areas are primarily reserved for cities. But if fiber internet is available in your area, it's worth considering over cable, DSL, and other sorts of internet connections. What is fiber optic internet? Fiber internet sends internet signals via glass wires either straight to the home or to a node just outside the home. The technology allows higher bandwidth and faster data transmission than any other connection type and has a unique capability of delivering symmetrical or near-symmetrical download and upload speeds. Fiber internet uses a different type of modem than DSL or other equipment used for cable. In fact, fiber technically doesn't use a modem at all, but an optical network terminal that performs the same function. All fiber internet providers use similar technology, but you'll find that prices speed tiers, and terms of service vary among providers, and that's why certain fiber providers stand out above the rest. The FCC's affordable broadband program is starting to make a dent. More than 10 million households have signed up for the Affordable Connectivity Program, but millions may still be left behind. 10 million households have signed up for the Affordable Connectivity Program, and the program was funded at a cost of $14.2 billion under the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill. The program, designed for low-income Americans, offers eligible households up to $30 off their monthly internet service or up to $75 off for those living on tribal lands. The Affordable Connectivity Program grew out of the pandemic-related funding provided under the Emergency Broadband Benefit Program, which offered low-income households up to $50 off their monthly bills. That program came together quickly and was marked early on by technical problems that made it nearly impossible for some Americans who had been approved for the program to actually sign up for service with their internet providers. Some providers were also found to be stretching the rules laid out by the FCC, which required people enrolled in the program to actively opt into full-price internet service whenever the funding for the discounts ran out. That approach was designed to prevent low-income Americans from getting hit with surprise bills they couldn't afford. But Spectrum was requiring people to opt into undiscounted coverage as a condition of enrollment, a requirement the company did away with shortly after it was reported. Verizon was also caught forcing customers into more expensive plans in order to enroll. The forced starts raised questions about whether the Affordable Connectivity Program was really making a dent in the digital divide. One study last summer estimated that 36 million households might actually be eligible for the program. At the time, just under 4 million households had enrolled. But even with 10 million households enrolled, tens of millions of eligible households may still be left behind. According to calculations, in 2021, there were 38 million households at or below 200% of the poverty level in the United States, which would make them eligible for the program. The FCC and its local partners will now be holding enrollment events over the next month to both raise awareness for the program and train navigators who can help people to enroll. A key supplier of wafers for chips has sold out through 2026. Sumco, that's S-U-M-C-O, expects supply-demand imbalance to last 5 years. Silicon wafer maker sees little room for factory expansion. Sumco Corporation is a key supply of silicon wafers for the semiconductor industry, said it has already sold out its production capacity through 2026. A sign that shortages in the industry may not abate for years. The Japanese company, one of just a handful of companies to provide the specialized silicon slabs that chip makers use to create their designs, has orders to cover all output of its 300-millimeter wafers for the next 5 years. It is not taking such long-term orders for 150-millimeter and 200-millimeter wafers, but demand is likely to keep surpassing supply for years to come, the company said. The price of wafers rose by 10% in 2021 over the previous year, and Sumco expects to see increases continue at least through 2024. The company said it won't be able to expand its production this year at all, despite strong demand from customers desperate for long-term supplies. It has already done what it can in terms of optimizing existing production lines, and its supply-demand imbalance is consistent across its full range of products. Another company, Taiwan Global Wafers Company, recently failed in its bid for regulatory approval of a $5 billion takeover of Germany's Siltronic AG, a move that would have brought consolidation to this sector of the chip supply chain. Taiwan Global Wafers needs now to reassess their strategy after Siltronic deal fell through. If there is a shortage of silicon wafers, You may ask, why not just build more plants to meet demand? If it was only that simple. A wafer fabrication plant can cost up to $10 billion to construct with all of the necessary equipment. So while silicon might be a very abundant element because it comes from sand, the creation of a silicon wafer factors heavily into the price. And then if we can get over the shortage in silicon wafers, then that follows the addressing of the process of creating the semiconductor chips. Of course, and the equipment to build the foundries to create the semiconductor chips costs upwards of $30 billion each. The silicon wafer in the supply chain. The shortage in semiconductor chips stretches over a lengthy spectrum of components and processes in the supply chain. Before the semiconductor foundries can create the semiconductor, you need the availability of silicon wafers. If you're like most people, the word silicon wafer will probably create a blank stare. That's because most people aren't aware of the important role of these thin chips played in our everyday lives. You might be surprised to learn that silicon wafers are a key component in the manufacturing process of our most commonly used electronic devices. Silicon wafers are valuable semiconductors that help the circuits of these devices run smoothly. Despite their importance, silicon wafers continue to do their job in anonymity. Why are silicon wafers used in electronics? Silicon wafer manufacturing has experienced a surge in recent years, not because silicon is the most effective semiconductor, but because the element presents the right combination of factors to make it especially suited for mass manufacturing. Silicon is not just a useful semiconductor, it is one of the most abundant elements on Earth, making it a cost-effective option for electronics. What is the role of silicon wafers in electronics? As mentioned, silicon wafers are used as semiconductors in electronics, specifically in the manufacturing process of integrated circuits. Integrated circuits, otherwise known as ICs, are a combination of electronic components that work together to perform a specific function. ICs can hold hundreds or millions of transistors, resistors, and capacitors, and are essential in the function of electronic equipment. There's no silicon wafer without, well, silicon. This element makes up close to 30% of the Earth's crust, but there is not just lying about on the ground, or is it? You might be surprised to learn that silicon is extracted from silica sand, but in its natural form, silica has too much oxygen to be silicon, so the material is mixed with carbon and heated in an electric furnace to a temperature beyond 2,000 degrees Celsius. At these temperatures, silicon separates from impurities like calcium or aluminum, leaving a product that is 99% pure. You would think that 99% purity would be enough, but for a semiconductor to function optimally, you want that to get as close to 100% purity as possible. The process is highly technical and filled with technical terms that are difficult to understand, but it can be summed up this way. The extracted silicon is ground down to a fine powder, mixed with hydrogen chloride, and heated until it turns into a liquid. This process creates additional unwanted elements through distillation and evaporation, leaving a final product that is, get this, 99.9999 pure. After the purification process, there's another step. The next step in silicon wafer manufacturing is creating a silicon ingot. Once the silicon is purified, the final product maintains small microcrystal formations that make it difficult to transfer electrical signals. To formalize the structure, manufacturers use a method which involves melting the silicon crystals once again, but this time over a quartz crucible, then inserting a tiny silicon crystal in the mixture and rotating it in the opposite direction of the crucible spin. This process helps attract silicon from the crucible and creating an ingot that is free of crystallized structures. Purification and making an ingot are arguably the most important steps in silicon wafer manufacturing. Once we have a fairly pure silicon ingot, it is sliced into a wafer. These wafers are very thin and they need to be uniform, so the cutting is done with a diamond edge saw blades. These blades allows manufacturers to get a fairly thin cut. The diameter of the wafers varies depending on which type of circuits they will be used. Naturally, smaller circuitry will require smaller wafers. The largest silicon wafers used for semiconductors, which are in shortage right now, are about 12 inches or 300 millimeters. The cleaning process is another key aspect of silicon wafer manufacturing. Tiny particles can cling onto the surface of a silicon wafer and interrupt the flow and transfer of electric currents. Silicon wafer manufacturers must be extremely careful when finishing cleaning the wafers, which is why this process takes place in a clean room and requires workers to use specialized gear that helps keep any external particles from finding their way onto the surface of a wafer. The end of free Google storage for education. In 2014, Google made an offer you cannot refuse. Anyone with a Google Apps for Education account in the United States got unlimited storage for free. The logic was sound at the time. 3 years earlier, the tech giant had launched the Chromebook. Cheap, robust, and secure. The web browser-based kit was a natural fit for education. The cloud was its primary storage. So what could be better than making that bigger than any hard disk in a Mac or a Windows PC? The idea was that if you catch users when they are young, they're yours for life. That was the axiom that had been tested by both Apple and Microsoft. Google played on its own strengths as the first cloud-native platform for everyone, and it was good. 7 years later, Google has killed the deal. The tech giant announced the end of Infinity in a blog post named "With Magnificent Chutzpah, More Options for Learning with Google Workspace for Education." In place of all that you can stash, each institution in the scheme was getting a total pool of 100 terabytes to give to student and teacher alike. If they wanted anything more, the cash register was open. For a small primary school with a couple of hundred pupils, this was perfectly adequate. However, a large science-heavy university could easily have a single experiment using all that storage. That announcement was a year ago and gave existing users 18 months of grace, with new users denied the unlimited package. Those with experience of academic deadlines won't be surprised that it has taken this long for lots of people to notice. Now online, there are cries of despair and pain. Others, though, are more sanguine. "What do you expect?" they ask. "What did you plan for?" Their logic is as sound as that which birthed the deal in the first place. There really are more options for learning. The first point is that Google has pulled more plugs than, well, anyone else I know of. Projects and products are closed without compunction. There are many who still mourn many of the Google applications, but there are many others who paid attention. Google's reputation won't suffer further this time. Also, the deal done its job. Chromebook is fully afloat in education, and Google's way of working is part of the personal and business landscape. And if you need many terabytes, there are lots of affordable options. Storage prices have halved since 2014. Some underlying assumptions don't hold, though. As students advance, their use of a particular educational account may increase in size but reduce in duration, which would seem to naturally limit Google's exposure. But there was lots of fraud, with unlimited Google accounts changing hands online. And while a lab needing 100 terabytes might have been rare in 2014, those rules of engagement have since changed. It was very tempting for academics to assume they have no storage cost, either for hardware or management, when costing a project for a grant application. They're in trouble now. If you're a small outfit, you may need to be your own admin. but you have no one else to blame if you don't do your disaster recovery drill. Data only exists if it's in three places, and backups only exist if they've been recovered. The best lesson, though, is that if you're not directly involved, you most likely haven't heard that this was going on at all. Those cries of pain are muted. Google has turned off a huge commitment in a very important sector. It has taken a while, and it's by no means universal. But the realization that free can be very expensive is sinking in for users and suppliers alike. Sustainability is an absolute duty in business as in everything, if you want a relationship to last. In the physical world, everyone knows where the free sample leads. In the online world, we're seeing the collapse of the hidden, unregulated market in personal data as the damage it does is exposed. And do you believe the rich pastures of tech IPOs can really support 1,000 unicorns? There may be less free room for academic data in the cloud, but there's a bit more reality now in our heads. So next time, when you're offered something for free, think. Apple to make AirTag device improvements. The $29 devices have become a headache for the company. Apple said that it would make improvements to its AirTag devices to make it more difficult for people to use them to track others without their knowledge. AirTags, tiny discs that Apple started selling for $29 last year to help people keep track of items like keys, wallets, and phones, have become a headache for the company. People have said on social media and in interviews that they have found the devices hidden on their cars and belongings, leading them to fear they were being stalked. AirTags use Bluetooth technology to ping nearby Apple devices, which then report the last known location of the AirTag to whatever device it's using it to track something. Apple said some built-in features like beeping automatically and notifying iPhones that an AirTag is nearby could help prevent abuse. But privacy experts and those who feared that they have been stalked said the features were not enough because they do not easily help people who carry phones that use Google's Android software. Law enforcement officials have warned that the devices could be used in attempts to steal cars, and women have said that they have found AirTags hidden on their cars and in their possessions, and sometimes have called the police. Apple's changes, which will be introduced this year, include the ability for someone who receives an alert that an AirTag is nearby to use his or her iPhone to find the AirTag through a combination of sound, haptics, and visual feedback. Users' devices will display an alert when a nearby AirTag emits a sound, in case the sound cannot be heard, and people will have the option to make AirTag beeps louder so that they can more easily find the tracking the device. Apple said it would also improve its alert system so that iPhones tell people sooner that unknown AirTags may be traveling with them. Apple needed to take more steps to prevent abuse, such as working with Google to extend protection to Android phones. Current fixes, such as an Android app that allows users to scan for AirTags, require people to proactively check rather than passively monitor whether they are being tracked. AirTags were designed to help people locate their personal belongings, not to track people or another person's property. Apple said in a news release that they condemn in the strongest possible term any malicious use of their products. Well, let's get the thing changed and get it fixed. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Posting of salary ranges in job ads.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, technology, and the workplace. In this case, this is something that overlaps both in the IT world, but also the regular employee-employer world. So I wanted to talk about this for a moment. There is an upcoming item that in April, New York City employers are going to be required to post salary ranges in any job advertisements. Now, this isn't anything revolutionary per se, because in Maryland and Washington, both states require employers to disclose the pay range for a position upon request. In California, if you are interviewed for a position, you may then request the pay range. In Nevada, they've got to employers have to pay provide the pay information to any applicant once they've been interviewed, even without a request. And it goes on and on. Connecticut must disclose the wage range upon the earlier of the applicant's request or when a job offer is made. And these, look, this is going on in various states and local municipalities, and it's going to continue. And I, when I see something like this, when I see this information transpiring and going back and forth, I'm reminded of this quote. And this quote comes from Robert Kiyosaki, who is the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I think it's actually from the book. Workers work hard enough to not be fired, and owners pay just enough so that workers won't quit. And I would attribute kind of this corollary that I'm developing here on the fly, a matter of workers are going to accept just enough to get the job, and owners are going to pay just enough to get that worker to take the job. It's an unfortunate series of balances that we go back and forth in this dance of negotiations over, will you take this much to work for us? Well, would you pay me this much to gain someone of my exceptional talents? And yes, there's a game that we all play, and it's unfortunate. Here's the thing. There's pros and cons in regards to including salary in job postings. I mean, employers would say that the salary shouldn't be the deciding factor. Well, the reality is, you know, we've got choices as employees. We can say, look, I'm not going to do that really level that high level of hard work for $4 an hour. That's ridiculous. And yes, at the same time, if you want to pay me $400 an hour, I might say, you want me to put the boxes where? You know, so there's always a balance. And employers sometimes pretend like there isn't flexibility. And sometimes to them, there isn't. This is what we're going to pay, and we've decided this, and it doesn't matter what you say. And we go back and forth with this. Now, posting salary gives employers less negotiating ability. It also gives employees, potential employees, less negotiating ability. If I see it, you know, something up there that says, hey, yeah, we're going to offer this job for $15 an hour. I'm going to clue you in. I'm an IT professional. I don't get paid $15 an hour. If they say $15 an hour and I go and I apply for that, there's kind of this implicit thing that I'm going to accept $15 an hour. Now, I might be able to talk them up a couple of dollars an hour more because of my, again, my exceptional abilities, but it's not likely to happen, not very far. So employers complain about how people can see how much the new hires are making, how much their coworkers are making. Although I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with all of us knowing what other coworkers are making. And it would help to keep the employers a little bit more honest in regards to paying, you know, a fair wage to the employees. And I want to be very careful. I think somebody uses fair wage as a political thing. I'm just saying this as just kind of a morals and scruples thing. Just a matter of, look, this person, I worked at a job once. They hired me on. I mean, we go back years ago. They hired me on and they said, we're going to have you do position X. Day one, they told me you're going to actually fire your boss and then you're going to take your boss's position. We're only going to pay you a technician's rate, even though you're going to be a director. But we'll pay you the director rate when you become the director. Okay, I can wait for that. They never gave, I mean, they gave me the director position, but said, well, we're tight on funds right now. We can't really give you the director wages until you've proven yourself. Yeah, they never did that. And then I moved on. But yes, there are pros to the employers, including salary and job postings. Yes, it's going to attract more applicants. It's going to promote openness and fairness. And it's going to, from the employee side, yes, it means that you're going to see, hey, this is where my potential is with this company. This is what kind of company I'm working for that's going to treat me like I deserve. Unfortunately, there's a lot of balance that goes back and forth here. And again, we get into that whole dance of the negotiation. All of these postings of salary ranges are not rules, but guidelines. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. A roundup of major news in the semiconductor industry. The semiconductor shortage has been described as due to a perfect storm of factors. There has been a flurry of activity in the semiconductor business. AMD closes record chip industry deal with an estimated $50 billion purchase of Xilinx. Semiconductor designer Advanced Micro Devices finalized the purchase of Xilinx in a deal value at about $50 billion. AMD Chief Executive Officer said that between AMD's processor technologies and Xilinx system on chips and field programmable chips, the two businesses are complementary. With the Xilinx acquisition, AMD will be able to increase its breadth in key markets like data centers, where Xilinx has a strong network and AI presence, as well as in the 5G communications, automotive, industrial, aerospace, and defense markets. Those are all markets that AMD has had very little presence in, and they all need high-performance computing as well. AMD is intensifying its battle with Intel Corporation in the data center chip market. The combined company of AMD and Xilinx will have more than 15,000 engineers and a completely outsourced manufacturing strategy that relies heavily on Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing. The companies expect the deal to generate $300 million in cost savings. Europe is running out of semiconductors. The shortage of semiconductor chips has exposed the vulnerability of European high-tech manufacturers that rely heavily on chip imports from Asia. The automotive sector alone, traditionally a European high-tech stronghold, is expected to take a $110 billion hit over the coming years as a result. Considering the importance and apparent vulnerability of the sector, the European Union is scrambling to implement initiatives to encourage domestic chip manufacturing and reboot innovation at home. Europe accounted for about 44% of global semiconductor manufacturing in 1990, compared to only around 10% today. This slow decline was a result of manufacturers failing to adapt to Asian and American competition. Research has shown that maintaining in-house research capabilities and academic collaborations will be key to the survival of European high-tech companies in the near future. In the long run, the best way to ensure resilience of Europe's high-tech industries is to largely decouple strategic industry sectors from economic sanctions and mitigate geopolitical risk. It would also reduce the risk of the IP theft in overseas manufacturing. Two of Europe's largest suppliers of semiconductor components have already moved a significant part of their production back to Europe. and that's Infineon Technologies in Austria and Bosch in Germany. Intel is buying Israeli firm Tower Semiconductor for about $6 billion. Intel looks to advance its strategy of contract manufacturing chips for other businesses. The purchase would deepen Intel's presence in a space dominated today by Taiwan Semiconductor, who is the world's largest contract chip maker. It also comes at a time when the global semiconductor shortage has hampered the production of everything from smartphones to cars. Tower Semiconductor specializes in analog chips used in the automotive, mobile, medical, and aerospace industries. It has a market capitalization of $3.6 billion, and Intel is getting a very well-run company that has been a foundry for a long time, as well as technology that it currently does not offer that will add to a broader foundry offering other than just bulk CMOS. In addition, the company gets more China business as well as military business, both of which are needed to support Intel's strategic direction. In essence, this deal covers multiple birds with one stone, which likely accounts for the premium price they're paying for it. Intel said it would invest up to $100 billion to build potentially the world's largest chip-making complex in Ohio. The move is aimed at restoring Intel's dominance in chip-making and reducing America's reliance on Asian manufacturing hubs. There aren't that many foundries in the world that Intel can buy that would potentially make a difference and make sense. China was taking a hard look at a number of Israeli-based technology companies because of its concern about being cut off from U.S. technology. Intel was also looking to buy global foundries for about $30 billion, but that deal fell through as global foundries decided to go public shortly afterwards. Chip making is expensive and difficult, so most companies either design or produce. Intel has opened up its factories to rival semiconductor designers to spread costs. Intel has a pay-as-you-go CPU. Intel's software-defined silicon, that's SDSI, mechanism for adding features to the Xeon CPU will be officially supported Linux 5.18, the next major release of the operating system. SDSI allows users to add features to their CPU after they've already purchased it. Formal SDSI support means that the technology is coming to Intel's Xeon processor that will be released rather shortly, implying Sapphire Rapids will be the first CPU with SDSI. Intel's software-defined silicon is a mechanism for activating additional silicon feature in already produced and deployed server CPUs using the software. While formal support for the functionality is coming to Linux 5.18 and is set to be available this spring, Intel hasn't disclosed what exactly plans to enable using it pay-as-you-go CPU upgrade model. We don't know how it works and what it enables, but virtually none of Intel's customers need all of the supported features, which is why Intel has to offer specialized models of all the different CPUs they have. But from a silicon point of view, all of Intel's Xeon scalable CPUs are essentially the same in terms of number of cores, clocks, and other features, with various functionalities merely disabled to create different models. Intel disabling certain features from certain models, then marking them appropriately and shipping them separately is an expensive process. It adds to logistical costs and the confusion added to the great number of products in that product stack. But what if Intel only offers base models of a Xeon scalable CPUs and then allows customers to buy the extra features when they need it and enable them by using a software update? This is what SDSI enables Intel to do. Intel has yet to disclose all the peculiarities of SDSI and its exact plans about the mechanism, but at this point we can expect this trickle down to the consumer CPU. Taiwan Top China chip maker warns of growing shortfall as it decouples from the United States. SMIC says customers want to secure local China supply. Manufacturers in China are increasingly looking to source chips locally because they fear the U.S. and other governments may prioritize domestic users of the semiconductors vital to national security. Customers are telling SMIC, that's Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corp., they need to secure a certain amount of capacity within China itself because of concerns the industry could become more fragmented, disrupting inflows from abroad. Companies in China have turned more and more to local component suppliers and assemblers. The White House is warning the chip industry to diversify its supply chain in case Russia retaliates against threatened U.S. export curbs by blocking access to key materials. A markets research group published a report highlighting the reliance of many semiconductor manufacturers on Russian and Ukrainian source materials like neon, palladium, and others. Over 90% of the U.S. semiconductor-grade neon supplies comes from Ukraine, while 35% of the U.S. palladium is sourced from Russia. The White House is working with companies to make sure that if Russia takes action that interferes with supply chains, companies are prepared for disruptions. Neon, critical for the lasers used to make chips, is a byproduct of Russian steel manufacturing. It is then purified in Ukraine. Palladium is used in sensors and memory, among other applications. Even if there was a conflict in Ukraine, it wouldn't completely cut off supply. It would, however, drive prices up. The market would constrict, and those gases would become pretty scarce, but it wouldn't stop semiconductor manufacturing. But the issue is still concerning, because global chip supplies are tight and chip orders are only expected to pick up. It is estimated demand for all the materials will rise by more than 37% over the next 4 years, pointing to recent announcements by Intel, Samsung, and Taiwan Semiconductor in Ohio, Arizona, and Texas. Neon prices rose 600% in the run-up to Russia's 2014 annexation of the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. Since chip firms relied on a few Ukrainian companies, according to the U.S. International Trade Commission. Taiwan Semiconductor approves of a $21 billion for chip production as potential for 2-nanometer production expansion opens. The Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company has approved more capital expenditure in order to expand its chip fabrication capacity. The Taiwan Semiconductor Company is the world's largest contract semiconductor manufacturer, and the company is now facing competition from U.S. chip giant Intel Corporation, who also plans to enter the market. Intel saw its cash flow drop last year as it committed billions of dollars to build new plants. With the approval, Taiwan Semiconductor has allocated a little over half of its fiscal year's 2022 capital expenditure, which the company announced at its latest earnings. Taiwan Semiconductor's second 2-nanometer chip plant in Taiwan sees potential open for expansion. The race between Intel and Taiwan Semiconductor is currently focused on developing the 2-nanometer chip manufacturing technology. Taiwan Semiconductor and the foundry arm of South Korean Samsung Electronics, Samsung Foundry, will both enter 3-nanometer production later this year, and Intel is believed to be sourcing some parts for its semiconductor products from the Taiwanese firm. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. More about COVID.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, you know, we're sitting here. We're right about the start of year seven, eight, year three?
Year three. You want to talk about the pandemic, don't you?
I do. It feels like. So, before we dive into this, one of the big concerns I've got is we don't have the time to cover all of the different scams, the different flim-flam snake oil items that we would normally. And actually, what about a year ago? We spent five episodes talking about the Hall of Shame. Yeah, it was just amazing, some of the different hokum that was coming out in regards to all of this. I want to know what you've seen.
You don't want to know what I've seen. You want to know what I know.
That has promise. Well, I want to know what you know that has promise.
All right. Let's go down a couple of routes specific to COVID, which is SARS-CoV-2, and it turns into the entire fraternity row alphabet of variants and all of that stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And it's a close relative to our good friend influenza B, and a not too distant relative of rhinovirus, the common cold. And what they all have in common is they're all ugly little asteroids with the same terrible haircut. All those little fronds coming up, those protein spikes. And it is those protein spikes that are finally allowing some progress. The protein spikes have positive charges at their end. And if you can find a way to neutralize those, you find ways to avoid those causing any further contagion. If you can't neutralize those, can you detect them? And there are electrostatic signatures and other methods that can allow detection of that. And we'll be seeing those in products very, very soon now. FDA emergency use authorization willing. And products that are, I'm happy to say, well within everybody's mad money range to buy. There's also UVC. Right. UV band C, the ultraviolet C, which is give or take 250, 60, 70 nanometer wavelengths, is pan-pathogen. With enough intensity, nothing's going to survive it. Not the virus, not a bacteria, not fungi, not anything. UVC can also blind you and burn your skin and do other things, so it needs to be used carefully. And as you said, there's a lot of stuff that was out initially that claimed to use it that really didn't, or used it poorly, or that caused more harm than good. But UVC remains viable as a way of pulling in air, of intercepting a virus when it leaves a sick person before it gets to a healthy one, and killing off the virus before anybody can breathe it in. So UVC is still on the table. Detection is interesting. Going back to detection, because in detecting the virus, there are so many strategies. You're going to detect it in the room? Are you going to detect it on an individual? Is the individual you or somebody else? If I walk up to you and I have the virus and I breathe on you, you have a way of knowing. Before very long, you will. Do you want a breathalyzer that can detect the virus? We'll have that too. Changes are coming. Major discoveries in the technology to detect the virus are proving out in labs. And I mean, 95 to 100% accurate, no false positives, no false negatives, readings in between 2 and 20 seconds. No waiting for the stick that you didn't put far enough up your nose. None of that
stuff. Which is... Yes. I've dealt with that one. Painful.
Yes. Not pleasant and not always accurate.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if that stick reaches where it's supposed to reach, that's the back of your throat. And that takes a medical person to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And then you feel like, what have I done wrong?
So we've got 2 minutes left. And I'm just thinking that the entire world has been waiting on some of this stuff, and
you want to know how many people are going to buy it?
I
can tell you, 2 to 5 billion in the first 6 months.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that it's going to be at a good price point. I look at how much Pfizer and Moderna have hit up our government for each of these individual vaccine shots.
Yeah.
And
I can tell you, it will be affordable. I'm not going to tell you the exact price point, but some of it will start at a price range where it's a no-brainer to buy it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, you know, it's not at a cup of coffee today range, mm-hmm. but it's at a cup of coffee for a while range. And I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, you know, and I can see that. If it's approachable to everybody.
Yes.
I'm just concerned that so many people see dollar signs. And
it may well be. Mm-hmm. It may well be that the government does step in, that it does buy it for a lot of people. The government mm-hmm. may step yeah, in yeah. and encourage the FDA to look for these solutions and speed the emergency use authorization process. Those things would be helpful. Mm-hmm. If we have any senators listening, any congressmen, if you want to help be champions in that, get a hold of me through the show.
Sure. That's
yeah. Get a hold of Ben. He'd love to talk to you about it. Interviews are available, and he's a charming fellow. If you can get him away from talking about how his whiskers make his beard itch.
Okay. That was different.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. The upcoming 46th Annual Original Personal Computer Festival, otherwise known as TCF, the original and oldest computer festival in the world, is March the 19th, 2022. It is a virtual festival via Zoom, and the website is tcf-nj.org. The time for the festival is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the keynote speaker is Bob Kopp. Disrupting Environmental Climate Changing Using Technology, and he is the co-author of the UN World Climate Change Report. He is from the Rutgers Institute for Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. At the festival, there will be other interesting topics of presentation, such as secure communications with quantum computing, computers changing photography, Bitcoin trading using neural networks, ham cram and testing, and a full day of presentations on IT professional topics. Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The time is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the website is tcf-nj.org. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Since most club meetings are online, you are most welcome to attend any of the online meetings. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation, Topics on Privacy, Thursday, February the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. It's a virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on disruptions at scale through innovation. Thursday, March the 3rd. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their monthly meetings on March the 4th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and the website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, March the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The restaurant no longer offers a free Wi-Fi, and a vax ID and mask is required, and the phone number is 347-278-7320 to confirm that the meeting is still on. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, March the 10th. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 11th. The starting time for the meeting is 7 p.m., it's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.